Today is Wednesday, March 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Worldwide cases of the coronavirus surpass 121,000.
In the days and weeks ahead, we expect to see the number of cases, the number of deaths, and the number of affected countries climb even higher.
Plus, former Vice President Joe Biden wins big on Mini Tuesday.
This campaign is taking off, and I believe we're going to do well from this point on.
We'll have all those stories and more next. As of Wednesday, the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University tracked the total number of COVID-19 coronavirus cases at 121,564. That includes 10,149 in Italy, the country with the second most number of confirmed cases. Iran, as of today, has 9,000, and South Korea has 7,755 after a spike in its numbers, with more than 240 people being infected at a single call center in Seoul. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he expected the number of cases to continue to rise.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic. Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly. It's a word that, if misused, can cause unreasonable fear or unjustified acceptance that the fight is over, leading to unnecessary suffering and death.
He added that with considered effort, nations could employ strategies to minimize community transmissions. One effort put in place that can be seen in Iraq, where the country canceled Friday prayers at the Shiite holy city of Karbala due to concerns about the coronavirus. Karbala, like neighboring holy city Najaf, attracts Shiites, pilgrims from Iraq and abroad. Prayers were also canceled last Friday as a precaution. As cases in Italy top 10,000, Australia has expanded its coronavirus travel ban to include that country as well. Restrictions were already in place for foreign nationals arriving to Australia from China, Iran, and South Korea. Now, in financial news, U.S. markets were trading lower at midday, a move that echoed markets in Asia, while European markets were mixed. The Bank of England slashed its key interest rate by a half of a percentage point to 0.25% on Wednesday in an emergency response to the economic shock of the coronavirus outbreak. The central bank said the move would help support businesses and consumer confidence at a difficult time. The cut follows similar reductions from the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada. The European Central Bank is also expected to announce a package of stimulus measures on Thursday. Taking a look toward the summer, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics that are slated to kick off this July. But a Tokyo Olympic Committee member told Reuters News if the Olympics can't be held this summer, a delay of 1 or 2 years would be feasible. Reuters' Libby Hogan has those details.
If the coronavirus makes the Tokyo Olympics impossible to hold this summer, an organizing official said a 1 or 2 year delay is realistic, and also said a cancel would be too costly. Up until now, the Tokyo Olympic Committee has been tight-lipped, not making a call about postponing or cancelling the Games due to begin July 24, despite speculation swirling. The official Haruyuki Takahashi told Reuters the Tokyo Organising Committee has started to work on scenarios for how the virus could affect the Games. He says the financial damage from cancelling the Games or holding them without spectators would be too great. On Tuesday, officials again insisted the Olympics would not be called off.
At this time, we are not thinking about canceling or postponing the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics at all. So there's no truth in suggestions that we are considering measures if that happens.
The latest budget for the Tokyo 2020 Games stands at nearly $13 billion. Japan's government pitched in more than $1 billion alone to build the Olympic Stadium. Experts say a one-year postponement to the same time next year would pose major logistical problems, but was doable for broadcasters because of their generally open summer schedule. Ultimately, the final decision belongs to the International Olympic Committee chief, Thomas Bach. Japan has reported nearly 1,300 cases, including the 700 from a cruise ship that was quarantined near Tokyo last month. On Tuesday, public broadcaster NHK said Japan saw 59 new cases, the biggest number of infections in a single day.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. The Russian parliament's lower chamber, the State Duma, has approved the third and final reading of a bill containing a constitutional amendment that would allow President Vladimir Putin to run for a fifth presidential term in 2024, meaning that he could conceivably stay in power until 2036. The constitutional changes must be approved by the Constitutional Court and will be considered legally approved if more than half of the country's voters support it in a referendum scheduled for April 22nd. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University, about the move and how it would shape Russian politics vis-a-vis the world.
Well, it's all very interesting because when he first announced these amendments in January, the amendments indicated that the powers of the presidency in Russia were to be reduced. And the indication was that obviously Putin wouldn't be interested in such a reduced role, and that the idea was that he was going to take some other role and supervise the new president. But what's clear is that I have a feeling that he can't find anyone to take this role whom he can control sufficiently. So he has to do this himself. Now, my sense is that even if these amendments that supposedly reduce the power the presidency passed, they won't have any real meaning, that he'll just continue as he has up until now.
One of the amendments approved by the State Duma will set Putin's previous presidential terms back to zero, giving him the right to run for a new term in 2024, and this raises the possibility that he could stay in power until 2036. How would that shape Russian politics vis-a-vis the world with Putin's aggressive foreign policy?
Well, it certainly indicates that there won't be a change in Russian foreign policy. I mean, I think one of the things that has been a feature of Russian Soviet history is that each new leader goes in a very different direction from the previous one in various issues. Some, of course, stay the same. But I think that, you know, if Putin remains, then we're likely to see the same, you know, anti-Western approach, the same, you know, activist approach in the Middle East and now increasingly Africa and Latin America, but at the same time, continued subservience toward China in Asia.
The constitutional changes must be approved by the Constitutional Court and will be considered legally approved if more than half of the country's voters support it in a referendum scheduled for April 22nd. What are the chances that such a referendum could stop the path for Putin as a president for life?
I don't think that anything's going to thwart Putin. I think that whatever he wants, whether it's a referendum or a decision by the Constitutional Court, that somehow it's all going to go the way he likes, and I don't see any real obstacle here for Putin.
Putin's framed the move as injecting stability into Russia's uncertain political future, suggesting that by staying in power, he could lead Russia toward a day when a change in power through elections would be possible. Is that a fair argument?
Well, it's a very funny argument. In other words, that if you just allow him to stay in for the rest of his life, then maybe one day there'll be a free election. Who knows? But I think it's a promise that I don't think the Russian public is going to be convinced by.
That was Professor of Government and Politics at George Mason University, Mark Katz, speaking to VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. On Tuesday, six states went to the polls, and Mini Tuesday, a Democratic primary, and former Vice President Joe Biden walked away with four out of six of the contests. Now, to see how Tuesday's results impacted the Democratic candidates for the party nomination to take on Republican incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump, I spoke with Matt Kerbel. He's a political science professor at Villanova University.
It's not just that Joe Biden won Michigan. He won every county in Michigan. He won Missouri by a lopsided margin. And in states where Bernie Sanders had done well 4 years ago, and particularly I'm looking at Washington State, it's too close to call right now, but that's a state where Bernie Sanders had done very well the last time. So I think the dilemma for the Sanders campaign, which we could anticipate coming out of Super Tuesday, is that he's not doing very well in a head-to-head race. You know, Bernie Sanders has a tremendously engaged group of supporters, but the dilemma he had all along is that he had a ceiling and he had a floor, and they were pretty close to each other. So when there were a lot of people in the race, Sanders could do well with 30-35% of the vote, but one-on-one against Biden, he's finding that he can't really build on that margin, and I think it's going to pose a tremendous problem for him going forward.
Is it really a referendum on Sanders as a candidate, or is it more on the Democratic Party in general saying, okay, maybe 4 years ago they weren't, you know, really thrilled with Hillary Clinton and they wanted to vote for some change. They were looking at Sanders, not thinking that Trump would get the nominee, let alone the White House. But this year the Democrats are really behind a concerted effort to remove President Trump from the White House and just want the best candidate to do that in a national election versus who they really prefer.
I think that's exactly it. I think that if you look at the turnout increases that we're seeing in Democratic contests across the country, Donald Trump is driving that turnout. And one of Bernie Sanders' theories of the case was that he would be able to build a constituency that would expand the electorate and propel him to the nomination. What we're seeing instead is that in places where turnout is up, it tends to be up because people are voting for Joe Biden. Now, let's not forget that Joe Biden's campaign was given up for lost about a month ago. So we are seeing this unbelievable turnaround in his fortunes. But as you said, I think it's because Democratic voters want a candidate who can build a broad enough coalition to win in the fall. And I also think it's significant that that Biden's turnaround coincides with the emergence of the coronavirus as a national story. So when you're operating at a moment when we're really facing a crisis, we're facing a health crisis and potentially an economic crisis. And we find that in times of crisis, people look for stable leadership, they look for competent leadership, and they look for compassionate leadership. And Joe Biden, for whatever problems he may have had, can speak to those issues. That's his brand. And I think that's why you see him doing so well.
And that was University of Villanova's political science professor Matt Kerbel. Moments ago, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said that he would continue his campaign to win the Democratic Party's presidential nomination.
Tragically, we have a president today who is a pathological liar and who is running a corrupt administration. He clearly does not understand the Constitution of the United States and thinks that he is a president who is above the law.
Sanders said that he is looking forward to this Sunday's one-on-one debate with Mr. Biden. And still to come on today's program.
A UN investigator is calling for Myanmar to be referred to the International Criminal Court and tried for alleged international crimes, including the persecution of ethnic minorities that had forced millions to flee, fearing for their lives.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of Belgian scientists studying an ancient mollusk was able to determine that some 70 million years ago, Earth made 372 rotations each year compared to the current 365 or 366 days in a leap year. That means a day was a half hour shorter than today. The researchers found that the ancient shell provided extraordinary details of its life and the water conditions it grew in, down to a fraction of a day. To make their findings, the researchers used lasers to examine and count the growth rings within very tiny slices of the mollusk shell. Scientists have found that Earth's rotation has been gradually slowing because of the gravitational effects of the moon. NASA scientists have determined that the day gets about 1.4 milliseconds longer around every 100 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is preparing to release 1,500 Taliban prisoners beginning this week, according to a decree viewed by Reuters News on Tuesday, after the U.S. agreed last month to begin withdrawing U.S.-led foreign forces so long as the Taliban keeps its commitments. Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks has more.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is getting ready to release 1,500 Taliban prisoners beginning this week. That's according to a decree Ghani signed, which Reuters saw on Tuesday. It requires all released Taliban prisoners to provide, quote, a written guarantee not to return to the battlefield. In exchange, the Taliban has agreed to hand over 1,000 Afghan troops. This prisoner swap has been the most contentious part of the U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed last month, and one that Ghani had rejected last week. The United States has already begun its part in withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. In return, the Taliban made pledges to dial down violence, like not cooperating with terrorists that target the U.S. The United Nations has backed the push to end war, but at a Tuesday Security Council meeting, the U.S. warned the Taliban to keep its promises.
We acknowledge the Taliban have taken steps to stop attacks in cities and against major bases. But more needs to be done, and we urge them to also reduce violence against Afghan forces in the countryside to give intra-Afghan negotiations and peace the opportunity to succeed.
Ghani's prisoner swap is supposed to help pave the way for his government's talks with the Taliban and would roll out over 15 days as the talks get underway. But a dispute over who leads the Afghan government may complicate the process. While Ghani was sworn in for a second term on Monday, his political rival, former Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah, said he's the country's rightful leader, and he held his own parallel inauguration, separated only by a wall. Both ceremonies were disrupted by a mortar attack on the presidential compound.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin urged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and challenger Benny Gantz to join together to form a unity government. That call comes in the wake of Israel's third inconclusive election in less than a year. Now, to break down things further and where they may go from here, I spoke with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The magic number then and now is 61. And what's kind of interesting is that right at when the exit polls happened about, 10 days ago after the elections, it looked like Netanyahu had 60. Then it went down to 58. However, Benny Gantz, the challenger, has his own problems. That said, there is a very strong public pressure not to have a fourth election. There's a sense that it's just a complete waste of time and money. What's interesting here, by the way, is that people right now are much more concerned with corona and Israel basically shutting its borders and about 100,000 people are in self-quarantine than they are in the political mess that is going on.
Is there enough pressure for Gantz to work with Netanyahu to form a unity government? Because he has said repeatedly that he does not want to sit in the government with Netanyahu, and his trial starts March 17th.
Well, yes, his trial is supposed to start March 17th, but again, he's put in a request for it to be delayed, and given the coronavirus emergency, it might actually be delayed. That said, it looked as of up until yesterday that Gantz was going to put together a minority government with the support of the Arab parties. They wouldn't actually join the coalition, but they would support it from outside. Now, a couple of his lawmakers, his more hardline lawmakers, want to sort of jump ship. That said, there's a lot of animosity between Netanyahu and Gantz, and I don't see him joining a government led by Netanyahu. I really don't think that's likely.
So at the end of the day, will Netanyahu be able to put together some sort of coalition with enough seats to govern?
It's still up in the air. I honestly don't know. I mean, what's possible is that he will do what up until a few days ago we thought Gantz was going to do, which is a minority government. The problem with a minority government that doesn't have 61 seats, that doesn't have a majority, is that it's inherently very fragile. There's going to be a lot of pressure on Gantz to join a unity government. Maybe he will. I honestly don't know. Or we'll have a deadlock, or, it's really everything is still open at this point. But what more and more people are saying is that Israel's political system, which is a parliamentary democracy in which you vote for a party and then the party with the largest number of seats tries to form a government, with three elections in a year and the results being pretty much the same, that the system isn't working and that somehow the system has to be changed.
That was reporter Linda Gradstein speaking to me from Israel. A United Nations investigator is calling for Myanmar to be referred to the International Criminal Court and tried for alleged international crimes, including the persecution of ethnic minorities that have forced millions to flee, fearing for their lives. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the investigator has submitted a report on Myanmar to the UN Human Rights Council.
This is Yangi Li's last report to the Human Rights Council as a special rapporteur on the human rights situation in Myanmar. When Li assumed her post 6 years ago, she says she was optimistic that by now democratic values would have been firmly established in the country. She addresses the council on a video link from Seoul.
However, devastation and tragedy transpired throughout my tenure on the mandate, and that rather than observing a nation that protects and respects human rights, the world continues to watch as rights violations routinely occur and Myanmar stands accused of the serious crimes under international law.
Li highlights the many alleged abuses resulting from the conflict between Myanmar's military and the insurgent Arakan army, which is now into its second year of fighting in Rakhine State. The Arakan army formed in 2009 and has been fighting in Rakhine against government forces. Li condemns an internet blackout imposed by the government 8 months ago. She says that is adversely affecting 1 million mostly ethnic people in Rakhine, including the Rohingya Muslim minority. Despite the blackout, Li says she is able to receive daily reports about villages coming under fire, people fleeing their homes, and many losing their lives.
As the government denies their ongoing persecution, in the past few months alone, Rohingya numbering in the hundreds have been intercepted on land or at sea, risking everything on perilous journeys to escape their homeland, only to be arrested, imprisoned, and charged with criminal offenses. I ask you to consider what would force you to make such a desperate choice.
Persecution and violence involving Myanmar's military against the Rohingya in August 2017 triggered a mass exodus of more than 700,000 members of this group. Most have sought refuge in Bangladesh. Investigator Li urges the international community to hold Myanmar accountable for its crimes. She says the country will not be able to transition to democracy unless there is an end to impunity. She says perpetrators of human rights violations and international crimes must face justice. Myanmar's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Kiyomo Tun, says it is of paramount importance that a special rapporteur listen to all sides of an issue in a professional manner and with good faith in order to draw conclusions in a balanced and impartial way. Without naming her, he accuses Li of failing to do so, thereby violating her mandate and becoming part of the problem instead of part of the solution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Japan marked the somber 9-year anniversary of devastating natural disasters and a nuclear accident on Wednesday as official commemorations and vigils were canceled because of the coronavirus. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said that since the disaster, reconstruction has been moving forward with the support and effort of many, and that they've received a lot of support from around the globe. The March 11, 2011 earthquake and tsunami triggered the worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl at the Tokyo Electric Power Company's Fukushima Daiichi plant, 220 kilometers northeast of Tokyo. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our production staff, thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.